The headlines: a bloody day for the Syrian military. Over a dozen people are dead in a twin explosion targeting an army bus in Damascus. A bill that gives Israeli police the free hand to search any home without a court warrant triggers worries among Palestinians. And controversy in Brazil. A Senate report wants President Bolsonaro to face mass homicide charges for the tragic results of his inadequate COVID response. Hello and welcome, everybody. Here in the Iranian capital, Tehran, this is World News. There are new developments out of Damascus, the capital of Syria, where a twin bomb explosion targeted a military bus a short time ago. 14 soldiers are dead and several others injured. Syrian television says that two bombs went off as the bus was crossing underneath a bridge. A third one has been defused. There's been no immediate claim of responsibility. Damascus witnesses acts of violence as such from time to time, especially since 2018, when the army retook the last significant rebel bastion near the capital. Our correspondent in Damascus, Mohammed Ali, has been there on the ground for us. He believes remnants of terror outfits in Idlib could be behind the attack, given reports that the Syrian army could be preparing to attack the terrorists in that part of the country. Let's listen.
It's very important to point out that it has been a long time since such a terrorist explosion targets the Syrian capital over here. And it's very important to point out that security had been restored to all of the areas inside the capital and its countryside. So there's no claim of responsibility yet on who is behind such an attack. But according to many analysts, it could be any terrorist group that is still occupying parts of Syria, namely Idlib, because there are some information during the past couple of weeks coming out from many sources that the Syrian army could be preparing for attacking the remaining terrorist groups in Idlib. So this could be perhaps this act of terrorism. This could be done by any terrorist group occupying that part of Syria in order to send a message that they are still perhaps capable of targeting the Syrian army or any place in Damascus. We have to wait and see what will come out.
Anger boiling over in Syria against the presence of U.S. forces there. Local residents have refused to allow an American military convoy to cross through their village in the northeastern province of Hasaka. The angry locals confronted the U.S. military vehicles throwing rocks at them and eventually forcing them to turn back and change course. The convoy consisted of three armored vehicles and a Humvee. Anti-American sentiment is running high in Syria. The U.S. has forces stationed in the northeast. It supports Kurdish groups there fighting the Syrian government. Damascus accuses Washington of violating its sovereignty and stealing its oil. Muslim scholars and intellectuals from around the world have attended the 35th Islamic Unity Conference in the Iranian capital, Tehran. The annual event puts into discussion the latest challenges in the Muslim world. Yusuf Jalali reports.
The 35th Islamic Unity Conference kicked off in Tehran with an eye for peace in a region that's gripped by unending crises. Over 500 Shia and Sunni clerics and thinkers from 39 countries took part in the week-long event to share their thoughts and viewpoints on the recent issues in the Muslim world. In his opening speech, Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi found the main source of problems in the Muslim world in division, the major profiteers of which, he said, are foreign actors in the region.
We seek to ensure stability in Islamic countries, unlike the enemy which tries to create instability. We believe unity is the strategy that the Islamic community should adopt, but the enemy's strategy is to sow discord.
This year's conference comes days after Daesh terrorists bombed two mosques in Afghanistan. More than 60 people were killed in the terrorist attack on a Shia mosque in Kandahar last Friday. The bomb assault came just a week after another terror attack killed more than 150 Shia Muslims during Friday prayers in the city of Kunduz. Both Shia and Sunni delegates at the Islamic Unity Conference denounced the carnage.
The Taliban government is responsible for protecting the lives of its people. If they want to continue to rule the country, they must stand with their nation and prevent such terrorist acts from happening again.
The main goal of terror attacks is to serve the Zionist regime, and that is to eradicate Islam and religion as a whole. They want to portray Islam as a religion of violence. They seek to pit Muslims against each other. So the major way out is that we Muslims sit and talk and have dialogue.
Participants at the conference say the terror attacks in Afghanistan were masterminded by the U.S. as an attempt to push the war-ravaged country into yet another crisis after Washington's humiliating retreat from Afghanistan.
America and American policies has failed in the region. Evidently, in Afghanistan, in Iraq, and everywhere. And today they want to save their faces and still say that for security we are needed in the region. Hence, they are mobilizing their own elements like those extremists and Daesh and other elements in the region. And they are attacking in the mosque, they are attacking in Husseinias, they are attacking Sunnis, Shias, and they are again playing the same old game in order to embroil the region in the same sectarian and division and schism which we are suffering till today.
The annual conference is organized by the Iran-based World Forum for Proximity of Islamic Schools of Thought. The annual event marks the Islamic Unity Week, which coincides with the birth anniversary of Prophet Muhammad as an axis that unites Muslims, regardless of which denominations they come from.
Delegates at the Islamic Unity Conference say Daesh re-emergence in Afghanistan is a Western plot aimed at completing the U.S.'s failed mission in Afghanistan by sowing discord between Muslims. They say the ultimate way out of this regional crisis is for Muslims to stay united and let the Afghan nation take its fate into its own hands. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Iran's ambassador to the United Nations has dismissed Israel's allegations against Tehran's nuclear program as unfounded and irrelevant. Majid Takht Avanchi said Israel is trying to play the victim in a bid to divert the attention of the international community from its crimes against Palestinian people. He said the regime's accusations are also aimed at covering up the threat that is that its nuclear weapons pose to the world. Takht Avanchi was speaking at a UN Security Council meeting. This came after Israel's ambassador accused Iran of trying to become a nuclear threshold state. Gilad Erdan also raised the possibility of a military attack against the Islamic Republic. Iran has time and again warned that it will give a crushing response to any acts of aggression against the country. Author and journalist Daniel Lazar believes Israel's threats to launch military action against Iran are a travesty of international law.
Israel has 200 or more nuclear warheads. It is not a signatory to the Nuclear Arms Anti-Proliferation Treaty. It does not abide by any international agreements regarding nuclear arms at all, yet it claims the unilateral right to restrict Iran from engaging in any kind of nuclear enrichment program of its own, and threatens it with military attack if Iran threatens to do so. So it just makes no sense at all. It's a classic case of the strong making law, to benefit their own side. It's just a complete travesty of anything resembling international good faith negotiations.
Palestinians are concerned about an Israeli bill which they say increases surveillance of their population under the pretext of curbing crime. A Palestinian legal defense organization says the new legislation gives Israeli police the free hand to search any Palestinian home without a court warrant. The organization is worried the bill could be used to terrorize people and increase tension among Palestinians. Israel's parliament, the Knesset, is set to vote on the bill, but it's not yet clear whether the legislation will get a majority vote. A Palestinian who's been on hunger strike for 3 months is now in intensive care. Mehrdad Al-Qawasmi is at the Israeli Kaplan Medical Center. He's suffering from a weakened nervous system. Two other prisoners who started their hunger strike more than 2 months ago are also in hospital. The three inmates have been refusing to eat in protest at administrative detentions. The system allows the holding of Palestinian prisoners without charge or trial indefinitely. Hundreds of Palestinians locked up in Israeli jails have staged a hunger strike in recent weeks. The collective action is in response to harsh jail measures. The restrictions came after six Palestinians escaped Israel's Gilboa prison in September. They were recaptured later, but the prison break shattered Israel's security image. The UK Defense Secretary says investigations into British troops' alleged abuses in Iraq have closed without a single prosecution being brought. Ben Wallace said thousands of allegations against British troops serving in Iraq between 2003 and 2009 were looked into, adding that no soldiers were prosecuted. Wallace said a body investigating the allegations has, quote, officially closed its doors. He, however, stressed that some shocking and shameful incidents did happen in Iraq. The defense secretary did not elaborate about those incidents. The allegations investigated were about Iraqi civilians' claims of serious criminal behavior from British armed forces. A group of British Muslim parents have protested outside a primary school in East London. They are deeply concerned about controversial relationship and sex education lessons for their children. The parents have also expressed anger as school managers refuse to talk to them over the issue. The lessons have angered religious groups as well. Robert Carter reports on that.
Tensions have reached boiling point in East London as Muslim parents protested outside school gates. The parents are deeply concerned over the Manorfield Primary School's relationship and sex education lessons, but also angered over the staff's refusal to negotiate.
This isn't the first time that British Muslim parents have protested outside school gates over this controversial issue. However, the organisers have assured me that this won't be the last time either, unless the school can come to some kind of compromise with the protesters. However, what is key to also note is that it's not just British Muslims that have expressed concern over these types of lessons. Also, Jewish and Christian members of the community have voiced their criticism too.
The relationship lessons, also known as RSE, are now compulsory in all UK public schools. RSE have been condemned in the past for peddling secular views on relationships which trample over religious beliefs, including same-sex marriage and details about human private parts.
That's the sensitivity that, you know, kind of infringes on our faith, because then it's a bit too close to home. You can address these issues, but use different names, use different material that is faith sensitive to us.
Emotions are running high, with some parents feeling fearful about what their children are being taught.
So if my child doesn't understand, how are you going to teach him certain things? He doesn't come home to tell me. He's learned this, he's learned that. You know, it really upsets me that I have to talk to the teachers and the teachers don't always tell me what he's done throughout the day. So him, he's very sensitive about certain things as it is. So I'm not sure what's going to go in his mind or what's going to affect him.
From our perspective, they've not been transparent as to what's going in, what's being taught. And to be honest, it's created a mistrust for the parents with the school, because we're just not sure exactly why they're including it, because they're choosing not to communicate.
The protesters demanded to be seen by the head teacher. He refused to show. Press TV also tried to get a reaction from the school, but they denied the chance. Now that the UK has opened up following COVID, attention is again returning to these controversial issues. Robert Carter, London.
Moving on to Brazil, where a congressional panel is working to introduce mass homicide charges against the country's top official. President Jair Bolsonaro is facing heavy criticism over his handling of the coronavirus pandemic. A Senate probe says Bolsonaro's neglect and opposition to science have cost hundreds of thousands of lives. It also accuses the Brazilian president of delaying the inoculation campaign in hopes of achieving herd immunity. The panel is also calling for charges against Bolsonaro's sons for spreading misinformation. The president says the probe is simply a joke. More than 600,000 Brazilians have lost their lives, making the Latin American country number two in terms of COVID fatalities, just after the United States. And the controversy over the deadly assault on the U.S. Capitol seems far from over. A congressional committee investigating the riot has now voted in favor of contempt of Congress charges against Steve Bannon, an aide to former President Donald Trump.
Mr. Chairman, I move that the committee favorably report to the House the committee's report on a resolution recommending that the House of Representatives find Stephen K. Bannon in contempt of Congress for refusal to comply with a subpoena duly issued by the Select Committee to investigate the January 6th attack on the United States Capitol, as amended.
Bannon was charged after he refused to comply with this subpoena, and members of the House Select Committee also accuse him of having prior knowledge of the attack. Trump has been seeking to prevent his closest allies from celebrating with the probe. At least five people died in the riot in early January when Trump supporters stormed the Congress building in a bid to reverse the 2020 presidential election results. The House of Representatives is set to vote on the matter later this week. North Korea says it has successfully test-fired a new type of submarine-launched ballistic missile. North Korean media say the weapon was equipped with advanced control guidance technologies. They say the missile was fired from the same vessel used in its first such test 5 years ago. Earlier, South Korea's military reported a similar occurrence, noting that the missile was fired toward the sea. The recent launch from the North follows Washington's renewed calls for talks with Pyongyang. The U.S. and its regional allies have been expressing concern about the North's missile tests. Last week, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, however, described the United States as a root cause of instability on the Korean Peninsula. Jennifer Chang says the latest missile test by North Korea is considered as the most powerful demonstration of Pyongyang's military might since Joe Biden took office as the U.S. president.
Well, this is considered to be the most powerful demonstration of North Korea's military might since the new U.S. president, Joe Biden, took office, because this is a submarine-launched ballistic missile that the North can send to near the coastline of the U.S. mainland while evading all U.S. missile defenses and basically destroy any U.S. city with a nuclear-tipped ballistic missile on such a submarine. So now the North has done four tests just last month, and this is the most dangerous one of them all to the U.S. And this is causing the U.S. to be under pressure, even more pressure than it was after the four tests last month than it was then. And right now, the U.S. is just in a flurry of diplomatic activity. The U.S. nuclear envoy for North Korea, Sung Kim, met with his Japanese and South Korean counterparts in Washington this week, and he is going to come to South Korea, to Seoul, to meet with his South Korean counterpart again to try to jumpstart stalled negotiations with North Korea.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. We are in the Unity Week. This week begins on the 12th and ends on the 17th of the Islamic month of Rabiul Awwal. Every nation owes its glory and grandeur to unity and solidarity. The Prophet of Islam, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, removed all barriers of unity like racial discrimination, seeking of supremacy, ethnicity, and so on. He set up unity in the society in the general sense of the word. The corrupt and ignorant society of Arabia at that time was devoid of any rules of government or policy. In such circumstances, the Messenger of Mercy gathered all existing groups and ethnicities in Medina under his aegis. In today's episode of Unity Week, we are going to have a glance at some of the Prophet's measures to establish unity among Muslims. Stay tuned, please. The religion of the Prophet of Islam enjoyed programs and objectives for enhancement of people's cultural and intellectual level. These programs required a comprehensive establishment to implement. Had there not been the Prophet's prudence, precision, and insight, the Islamic government would not have materialized. One of the hindrances on the way of the Prophet was the lack of a coherent structure in the society. Every tribe and group had their own special customs, and there were myriads of contrasts and differences. Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, however, employed a very calculated tactic to advance his goals. It was the rule of every Muslim is the brother of other Muslim. He created social unity to break up tribal and ethnic borders. This plan had many positive effects. Thus, the people of Medina as the Ansar or helpers warmly welcomed the people of Mecca or Mujahideen or migrants. This sympathy was to the extent that the people of Medina supported the migrants who had left their homes and hearths by sharing their houses with them and providing them financial assistance. Mosques had a significant role in the first years of Islam in bolstering unity and convergence. All Muslims took part in building the first mosque. Even the Prophet himself helped Muslims by bringing stones for the mosque. One of the companions approached the Prophet saying, "O Messenger of God, let me bring the stone." The Prophet said, "Go and fetch another stone." The mosque became the Prophet's house, place of worship, and the center of unity of the Islamic Ummah. Upon Islam's sunrise in Arabia and its rapid spread in the whole peninsula, Abu Amr, who was a Jew, was infuriated and tried to disintegrate the unity of Muslims through conspiring with hypocrites of the two tribes of Aus and Khazraj. He wrote in a letter to his accomplices, "Build a mosque in the village of Quba, opposite to the Mosque of Muslims, and gather together at the times of prayer so that the spiritual power of Muslims diminishes. Then, discuss the ways of overcoming Islam under the guise of performing prayer." When the Prophet set out for Tabuk battle, the delegates of hypocrites came up to him, saying, "O Messenger of God, the elderly and sick people cannot come to the mosque at rainy nights. So, do you let us build a mosque in our neighborhood?" The prophet looked at them thoughtfully, but didn't say anything. Then, as he saw their insistence, he said that he would deal with the problem after returning from the journey. Yet the hypocrites built a mosque in the absence of the prophet. When Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, came back to Medina, they asked him to inaugurate the mosque in praying in it. At that moment, Gabriel descended and exposed their conspiracy through revelation of Ayah 107 of Surah Tawbah, which reads, "As for those who took to a mosque for sabotage and for defiance, and to cause division among the faithful, and for the purpose of ambush by those who have fought Allah and His Apostle before, they will surely swear, 'We desired nothing but good,' and Allah bears witness that they are indeed liars." Then the Prophet ordered the mosque to be destroyed. In fact, this measure was aimed at preventing political rift and discord in the society. The agreements that the Prophet of Islam signed in Medina were among the most obvious approaches for unity in the Islamic society. The first agreement was concluded with the tribes and ethnicities in the city, which had been called by some as the first written constitution in the world. This prudent move was the best choice for creation of national unity and religious solidarity. Parts of the agreement read, "Muslims are a monolithic ummah separate from other people. They will be united against oppression, aggression, conspiracy, and corruption. If a difference emerges among Muslims, the reference for solution will be God and His Messenger. Muslims will not leave alone a heavily indebted person. They will rather help him." Other paragraphs of the agreement show the Prophet's effort to build unity and friendship in the society. Other parts of it read, "Muslims and Jews are a single community and live in Medina like a nation, while each of them has its own religion. The allied Jew will be helped. Muslims and Jews should struggle against those who rise against this agreement. Both of them should help one another to fight against aggressors to Medina." Dear listeners, unity does not mean that there must not be any difference in any matter. It does not mean either to follow a single language or set of rules. Muslims enjoy different languages, races, and ethnicities. Unity means being a single body against common enemies. It means to insist on shared beliefs and laws in pursuit of common goals. This unity was the key to make Muslims the masters of sciences and civilization for centuries. This is the element of success and glory today, too.
Us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Iran's president is urging Muslim nations to remain united and refrain from division. Addressing an international conference on Islamic unity in Tehran, Ebrahim Raisi stressed that Palestine is the most pressing issue of the Muslim world now. He also urged the Muslim community to stand up to terrorist groups such as Daesh. He insists that corruption, poverty, and terrorism should be eradicated from the Islamic world. Now, the president also encouraged closer scientific, cultural, and media cooperation among Muslim nations.
The 35th Islamic Unity Conference kicked off in Tehran with an eye for peace in a region that's gripped by unending crises. Over 500 Shia and Sunni clerics and thinkers from 39 countries took part in the week-long event to share their thoughts and viewpoints on the recent issues in the Muslim world. In his opening speech, Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi found the main source of problems in the Muslim world in division, the major profiteers of which, he said, are foreign actors in the region.
We seek to ensure stability in Islamic countries, unlike the enemy which tries to create instability. We believe unity is the strategy that the Islamic community should adopt, but the enemy's strategy is to sow discord.
This year's conference comes days after Daesh terrorists bombed two mosques in Afghanistan. More than 60 people were killed in the terrorist attack on a Shia mosque in Kandahar last Friday. The bomb assault came just a week after another terror attack killed more than 150 Shia Muslims during Friday prayers in the city of Kunduz. Both Shia and Sunni delegates at the Islamic Unity Conference denounced the carnage.
The Taliban government is responsible for protecting the lives of its people. If they want to continue to rule the country, they must stand with their nation and prevent such terrorist acts from happening again.
The main goal of terror attacks is to serve the Zionist regime, and that is to eradicate Islam and religion as a whole. They want to portray Islam as a religion of violence. They seek to pit Muslims against each other. So the major way out is that we Muslims sit and talk and have dialogue.
Participants at the conference say the terror attacks in Afghanistan were masterminded by the U.S. as an attempt to push the war-ravaged country into yet another crisis after Washington's humiliating retreat from Afghanistan.
America and American policies has failed in the region. Evidently, in Afghanistan, in Iraq, and everywhere. And today they want to save their faces and still say that for security we are needed in the region. Hence, they are mobilizing their own elements like those extremists and Daesh and other elements in the region. And they are attacking in the mosque, they are attacking in Husseinias, they are attacking Sunnis, Shias, and they are again playing the same old game in order to embroil the region in the same sectarian and division and schism which we are suffering till today.
The annual conference is organized by the Iran-based World Forum for Proximity of Islamic Schools of Thought. The annual event marks the Islamic Unity Week, which coincides with the birth anniversary of Prophet Muhammad as an axis that unites Muslims, regardless of which denominations they come from.
Delegates at the Islamic Unity Conference say Daesh re-emergence in Afghanistan is a Western plot aimed at completing the U.S.'s failed mission in Afghanistan by sowing discord between Muslims. They say the ultimate way out of this regional crisis is for Muslims to stay united and let the Afghan nation take its fate into its own hands. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Welcome to the Spotlight. I'm your host, Behruz Najafi. Allow me to introduce our guests in this edition. We have the director of the Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought, Zafar Bangash, in Toronto. Also joined by head of the Islamic Human Rights Commission, Masoud Chajareh, in London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to the spotlight, gentlemen. Let me start with Tirana. Mr. Bangash, unity and refraining from division is one of the highlights of the Iranian president's speech at the international combat underway here in Tehran. Let's talk about the significance of Muslim unity, and in special in this sensitive juncture.
Well, obviously, Muslim unity is essential if the Muslim world is to address the numerous challenges and problems that it faces, and in particular, for instance, the issue of Palestine. Now we face another challenge in Afghanistan. There has been ongoing war against Iraq and Syria and Lebanon and Yemen, etc. And when we look at these challenges that the Muslim world faces, all of them have foreign interference involved in them. And foreigners are only able to instigate these problems and conflicts because they have managed to create divisions among Muslims. If Muslims were united, then obviously they would be able to face these challenges much more effectively. We can look at it another way. The divisions in the Muslim world are like a virus inside the Muslim Ummah's body. And when there is a virus inside a body, it is weakened, it is involved in fighting that internal virus, and the external environment therefore is able to attack the body much more forcefully. Mm-hmm. If the body were healthy, that means it were united, then any external threat would be less severe and Muslims would not face the challenges that they are facing. So when we talk about Muslim unity, we obviously have to understand that it is essential in order to ward off the many, many challenges that the Muslims are facing. I also want to point out that Muslim unity does not mean Muslim uniformity. Unity means there should be a unity of purpose, the unity of interest. Mm-hmm. And I think when we look at all of these various challenges that the Muslim world faces, there is definitely unity of purpose and unity of interest. And towards these goals and objectives, Muslims need to unite. There have to be certain practical steps taken by the Muslim world. Now, when we talk about the Muslim world, I think we need to make a distinction between the Muslim masses and the Muslim governments. I think at the level of the Muslim masses, there is unity. This is manifested in the fact that, for instance, the Muslim masses worldwide express their sympathy and solidarity and support for the Palestinian people. The same applies to the Muslim masses' worldwide support for the people of Kashmir or the Rohingya refugees or the people of Yemen, etc. So we see that at the level of the Muslim masses, there is deep unity. Regrettably, the same cannot be said about the level of unity within the Muslim governments, because Muslim governments, or at least some Muslim governments, have different perspectives than others, and so this prevents for the kind of effective unity that we are talking about. But I think these challenges can be overcome if at least some Muslim governments are able to come together, as we are witnessing today, as we saw in the defense of, for instance, Syria, as we saw in the defense of Iraq, as we saw in the defense of Yemen. I think there are some Muslim governments and movements that are prepared to stand up for Muslim unity. And the same applies to Palestine, which is close to everybody's heart, because Palestine is holy land, as well as the Masjid al-Aqsa, the first Qibla of the Muslims, is located. So these are very important steps that have been taken, and they have achieved notable results. Okay. Again, we need to be aware of the fact that there are imperialist powers that are constantly trying to create divisions among the Muslims so that it would weaken Muslim strength and dissipate their energies in their internal conflicts so that the imperialist powers can achieve their objectives.
Right.
But as I see the situation, definitely the Muslim world is on the ascendance. It is making great strides towards achieving unity. It is moving towards a direction whereby the Muslim world is able to ward off many of the challenges that have been thrown at them. We have witnessed this in Syria. We are witnessing it in Iraq, in Afghanistan, although Afghanistan remains a serious challenge, but at least the imperialist power and its allies have been driven out of Afghanistan, and that's a great achievement for the Muslims. So I think these need to be built on, and more efforts need to be made towards Muslim unity.
Okay, now let me turn to London. Mr. Shajar, go ahead with your comments.
Okay, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. The fact is this, that Muslim unity is not an option. It actually a command of Allah. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in the Holy Quran says, "Abtasimu bihamdillah jamia." Allah actually commands us to unite and hold on to rope of Allah. And then the following verse says, "Do you remember the time that you were disunited and I brought your hearts together?" So the unity is not just a political unity, although it should manifest itself politically as well, but the unity is on the level of heart, on the level of feeling for your brother, feeling for your fellow Muslim. And actually then everything else kicks in, that the honor of your brother, the need of your brother, the safety of your brother is your responsibility. And that sort of level of the unity which we saw in Medina between Ansar and Muhajirin and so forth, that sort of level of unity is a command of Allah, and we need to work towards that. There are many obstacles, and you know, since the Islamic Revolution, the West have been busy trying to find ways of disuniting us, forcing us out of having the vision of actually Muslim needs and aspiration in the world, against injustice, against bringing justice to everyone, including Muslims. And then also they are using these dictators who have been appointed by them, supported by them, and doing their bidding. And you know, then we see the normalization with the Zionists abandoning our responsibility to Palestinians, and goes on, undermining the Muslim identity and indeed the manifestation of it. Islamophobia is another tool, stick, which is being used to destroy the Muslims' self-confidence.
Right.
If we come together with self-confidence and move forward, and this needs to be done on all levels, but it is absolutely essential that we will have a purpose to come together for the unity, not just a hollow sort of concept. It is the purpose of actually supporting each other at the most difficult time, and Muslims are facing, as Brother Zafar highlighted, Muslims are facing many difficulties.
Right.
Palestine, Kashmir, but let us not forget places like Nigeria, where huge number of Mu'mineen are standing up against injustice, and they're being hammered, and the tool of division is being used against them, and we need to challenge those, and we need to come together.
Right. Okay, Mr. Shajar, you know that Muslim nations and governments have very good reasons to unite and to work together. The issue of Palestine and what has been happening there by the Zionist regime since 1948 is one of these reasons. How can Muslims rally around the occupation of Palestine?
Well, occupation of Palestine is a sort of a point which actually highlights, not just in the region, but worldwide. It highlights the issue of justice and injustice. And here the victims are Muslims, and you know, it really is basically one of the symbol of injustice and colonialism, which has destroying the region and beyond. And you know, the fact of the matter is that, as Zafar, the Zafar said, ordinary Muslims, I mean, indeed ordinary people are understanding this injustice. How we mobilize is actually we need to again go back to our responsibility towards each other and actually use every possibility we've got, financial and everything else, to use for liberation. But also we need to check on those who are creating havoc and supporting these injustice. We are seeing some of these dictators in the Persian Gulf are now becoming the champions of Zionists and promoting those injustices, and we need to speak out against them. And you know, I have to say, one of the other points that we normally forget is the rise of Islamophobia worldwide, which indeed we Muslims come together to address it. And it's really out of control now, be it in United States, Canada, Britain, and indeed even we are seeing the signs of Islamophobia in some so-called Muslim countries,
right,
where people are speaking out against implementation of Islam by Muslims.
Okay, that's right. Now, Mr. Bangash, Islamic awakening is another topic, you know, discussed recently in international Islamic forums. So what could be the fruits of Muslim nations' vigilance and awareness of the realities and developments unfolding around them in the world today?
Well, the first point is that we need to realize that who our enemies are, what are the forces that are creating these divisions among Muslims, and thereby, of course, stoking Islamophobia as well, because there are very large numbers of Muslims that reside in Europe as minorities, similarly in North America. And when we look around the world as to the countries that are being targeted by these imperialist and Zionist powers, then obviously they are targeting Muslim countries. Especially those Muslim countries that wish to break out of the stranglehold of these imperialist and Zionist and colonialist powers. And so they're targeting Muslims residing within their own societies as well. And that is what has given rise to Islamophobia. Mm-hmm. And it is a vicious, vicious campaign that has become more virulent over the years. More Muslims have been targeted and bullied. They are denied job opportunities, even though they are citizens of these countries. Right here in Canada, where I live, the Muslims as a religious group have been targeted the most. In fact, the most number of Muslims or of any religious group that have been killed in their places of worship are Muslims. And Canada is supposed to be theoretically one of the better places in the Western world. So if that is the situation in Canada, we can imagine what the plight of Muslims would be in other places. We can take the example of France, where in fact Muslims are now not even given job opportunities. I mean, Islamophobia has become official policy of many of these states.
Right.
And so it is this kind of awareness that needs to be made and awakened among Muslims, that their very identity and survival is at stake.
Right.
And for this, of course, you know, you mentioned Islamic awakening. That, of course, is at the larger level. But I think the awareness of Islamic identity itself is essential, that Muslims must stand up and defend their Islamic identity and not allow the Western powers and their demonic ideologies to distort the message of Islam. And we see, for instance, you know, there are all kinds of attacks on the noble personality of the Prophet of Islam. His you know, there are caricatures of him, cartoons of him insulting the Prophet, when in fact no other religion is allowed to be insulted like that. No other personalities are allowed to be insulted like that. And yet they think that they have the right to do so when it comes to Islam and Islam's revered personalities.
Right.
So in this sense, Islamic awakening is an essential part of this struggle.
Okay. Now let me ask you, Mr. Shajra, speaking about Islam, well, maybe Daesh and other terrorist groups like that, they have also contributed to this. So, and we know that this is, it has nothing to do with genuine Islam. So what can the Muslim community do to show that Daesh is just a project to tarnish the true face of Islam, which is a religion of peace? We have 1 minute.
Well, this is very obvious. It's very clear. It's very already exposed. Everyone knows that Daesh has got nothing to do with the Muslim community. Indeed, majority of victims of Daesh are Muslims, not non-Muslims. Daesh is killing more Muslims than anybody else. So this is actually a tool against Islam and Muslims. But one thing we need to be very clear, that there are criminals everywhere claiming to be whatever they are, and Daesh is no different to that. We are not answerable for those criminals. We should not fall into the position that we have to make excuses for Daesh because they are trying to associate Daesh with Muslims. One of the trick is to destroy the self-confidence of Muslims with Islamophobia, with use of Daesh, blaming the victims for the these atrocities which they have created and they are supporting. And I think the first aspect is we need to be confident. We need to be confident in ourselves, in our deen, in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Only then we could protect ourselves and people like Palestinians or Kashmiris and everything else. But the essential thing is that we have a confidence.
Okay, thank you very much. That's all the time we have. Let me thank our guests. We have Director of the Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought, Zafar Bangash in Toronto, and also Head of the Islamic Human Rights Commission, Masood Chajra in London. I've been your host, Behrouz Nedefi. I'll see you next time.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
تمام ارزش ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام میگذاره همه این ارزش ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali عليه السلام, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
Universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام البخل جامع لمساوئ العيوب وهو زمام يقاد به إلى كل سوء.
Imam Ali said, miserliness contains all other vices, and it is the rein with which one can be led to every evil.